Welcome to ArcLight Stories. I'm Chris Kinsley, story coach with ArcLight, and I'm joined by my co-host and director of ArcLight, Taylor Robinson.
ArcLight Stories features true, personal stories that are told live in front of an audience at one of our ArcLight events. At our events, we only have a few rules for our storytellers. You can't use notes, you can't use props, and it has to be a true story that you are in. I'm so excited about this episode. We're bringing you four stories today. A man gets a chance to show a former girlfriend what she missed out on. A girl gets an audience for one of her first intimate moments. And a young woman meets some random strangers and ends up in a fight.
But first, one of the strangest experiences we have in life is to see how our relationship with our parents changes as we grow older. And that's especially true as they shift from being authority figures to actually needing us to take care of them. And our first story is about just that. It comes from an event that we hosted a few years ago at Urban Standard here in Birmingham. The theme for the night was Thicker Than Water, Stories About Family. Here is storyteller Scott J. Ross.
So I'm going to tell you a story about my family and specifically about my mom. And one day, this was about probably 12 years ago, I got a call from her, and she had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And she called and said, "Scott, I have incredible news for you." And I was very excited, you know, to hear. And she said that she had been cured. And at that point, you know, that would be great news to most people to hear that your mom, who has cancer, that everybody has said she's going to die, all of a sudden calls and says, "Hey, I have been cured." You think, man, this is great. Most people would think that. But for me, I went into a defensive posture because my father, like the other gentleman that was up here, was a pastor. And many people chose to come and tell us what God had told them about my mom's sickness. And they would take it to such degrees, they were trying to make us feel better. So they would say, "Oh, well, the Lord told us that your mom is going to get through this and going to be better." And at first, the first couple of times, I kind of smiled and was, "Oh, well, God bless you. Amen. Thank you, brother. Thank you, sister." You know, and just kind of took it in, and I didn't react. But by, like, after a couple of months of this, you know, and we'd go to the doctor, and the doctor would say, "No, it's not looking good." And then we'd go and run into somebody at the mall, and they'd be like, "Oh, the Lord told me last night." And finally, I started to get a little cynical about it, and I was like, "Oh, really? So should I call my doctor, and like, maybe we should cancel some of the chemo, because it's really not good for her. Maybe she's going to be fine." And that was a little much. You know, people didn't know how to handle that. You know, they would get really scared, and, you know, sometimes they would cry, and I knew I was going too far at that point. So I was really nervous when she called. Because I don't know if you've been with a family member that goes through cancer and the chemo. Sometimes they're not necessarily the person that you've known your entire life. They kind of get a little bit off kilter. And this happened quite frequently with my mom. And it was honestly some of the funniest moments of my entire life were when my mom was just a little bit not her. And, you know, you just never would know what to expect. One time she was at my house, and this is my son Max, who's 12 years old, right when he was first born. And she gets done, you know, playing with Max and the baby and all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, this is great. It's my mom. It's a sweet time. And then she would just look at me, and she was furious. And she said, "I know what's going on here. You're sleeping with that woman." And I'm like, "I know, it's my wife." "Oh, no, you can't fool me. I know." And you'd be like, "Oh my gosh." And then, like, minutes later, she'd be back to normal. And you're like, "Whoa." And most of the time, she wouldn't remember what had just happened. And so you couldn't talk about it. So it was really funny. And it was so different than the mom that I knew. And, like, my dad was the pastor and my mom played piano. And they had like this fantastic story of how they met. And that's how I envisioned my mom, not this person that one time she's her and one time she's crazy. And so, but I just wanted to tell you a little bit about how special my mom was to me. And that I found out when I was in college, I used to work with some of the other guys here and doing theater and traveling around, and I got to preach some, which was really crazy. But I got to do all this crazy fun stuff, and I was a theater major in college, and I also traveled and preached and did stuff, and I found out, not until I was in my mid-20s, that my grandfather had been a theater major in college and also was a guy that traveled around and preached. And I thought that was really fascinating. And I asked a bunch of questions to my mom. We had this great time during the time before she passed, where we got to hear all these different stories. And she would tell me about them. And I found out during that time that actually my mother's father was a traveling evangelist guy. And he would go around to all these different places preaching. And Billy Graham, preacher guy, would come and listen to my grandfather. And I thought that was so cool. And it turns out that my dad's mom, other side of the world, was dating Billy Graham's brother. So they would all go together to go hear my mom's dad preach. And it was just this really neat thing. And I never got to meet my grandfather because he died when my mom was 9 in a car crash. And they ended up making this great relationship between Billy Graham and my mom's dad that went after he died, Billy Graham paid for my mom to go to whatever college she wanted to go to. And she went to Howard University, which became Samford, which is where I also went later. So she went there, and my dad, because his mom was friends with Billy Graham's brother, ended up going to Samford as well. And before he went, my dad got to work with Billy Graham for a summer on like a little crusade camp thing. And he said, when you get to Samford, I want you to look up Harold Johnson's daughter. And so it's really cool little connection moment where Billy Graham totally hooked my parents up. And it's weird, kind of creepy to think about, but that happened. And how they met was really cool because my dad is like this little traveling preacher guy too, and my mom plays the piano, and they get booked at the same thing. And so my dad's the preacher and my mom's the piano person. And my dad does the invitation, and my mom stops playing piano and comes down to the front during the invitation. And because she's really convicted about her life and wants to give her life back over to Jesus. And so it's really kind of weird meeting. And well, lo and behold, my grandmother says, okay, let's have little Bobby Ross, who's my dad, not the painter, because that'd be a totally different story. Let's have little Bobby Ross come over for lunch and he can bring his little girlfriend. And my dad's got a little girlfriend, and my mom is engaged to this guy, and nobody knows that when she came down front, she took the wedding ring off, and that was part of what she was, given over to God, is that relationship wasn't right. So they go to lunch at my grandmother's house, and my grandmother is, like, totally manipulating the whole scenario. And so, like, after dinner, or after supper, as they called it, after supper, she has the girlfriend who doesn't know she's about to get dumped and the fiance that doesn't know that he's about to get dumped. She makes them do the dishes so that my parents can sit out front, and my mom's playing the piano and they're singing songs. They were kind of like the NSYNC of that time. Not really. Is NSYNC? Nobody even knows what that is anymore. It's all right. And they were like this cool little, like they were singing and they would sing in harmony and it was really pretty. And then when the girlfriend or the fiance would come out, they'd slip back into melody and just kind of pretend like they weren't singing in harmony. And it's a little racy, I know. I apologize. I'll tone it down. I'll dial it back a little bit. So 4 days later, they get engaged. 4 months later, they get married. And they were married for 35 years. So these are special people to me. And they have a great history and a great story. And so it was really weird to see these people I have, grown up with my whole life because, they were there at the beginning. to see someone change and start acting in a way that you can't predict. I mean, like, my dad borrowed my car one time, and I know I'm 6'5", and I drove a Miata, I know it's a bizarre sight, but I loved it. And there's a lot of room in it. You just don't know. You have to be driving to feel the room that's in it. If you're in the passenger seat, it's very small. But they're driving downtown Birmingham. They had come up to visit. And they get to this intersection, and there's all these people around. And my mom decides at that moment to have one of her moments. And she starts screaming, "Help! Help! I've been kidnapped! I don't know who this man is!" And she starts screaming, and my dad is crying because he's laughing so hard. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, here's your bride of 35 years just screaming in panic because she says she's being kidnapped. And I mean, like, and it went on and on. And like, she would kick him out of bed. Like, they'd be laying in bed. And she'd look over at him and say, "I don't know who you are, but I'm married to Bob Ross. And if he comes in here and sees you, he will kick your butt." And in our family, that was a cuss word. I mean, that was an F-bomb right there. She just dropped it. That was big time. Big time for somebody to, you know, say the butt word. That's what we called it, the butt word. And then my dad would get out of bed, and he'd be half sad and half proud. Like, unbelievably proud that his bride, even though she can't see what's going on right in front of her and really put it all together, she was so committed and dedicated to him. So you get why I wanted to protect my mom from people telling her things like, "You're gonna be cured." Because everything that we had heard from the doctor was, there was no way. You know, this was, we were on a course. And so we had kind of adjusted to that course and tried to make the most of every single day. You know, when you talk about thicker than water, you know, you walk through death with your family on that kind of level, there's nothing thicker than it. I mean, you make a connection that kind of supersedes all other connections. So when she called and said I had been cured, I immediately, Mom, what do you mean? And she said, Oh, it's not cancer that I've been cured from. I said, okay. She said, what I've been cured from is thinking that I had the rest of my life to tell you everything I've always wanted to tell you. And to spend the rest of my life and then get around to telling Bob all the things that I wanted to tell him and the rest and your brothers. And she said, I know that I only have every day, and that is the sickness that I've had my entire life, is putting things off until tomorrow. So from that point, 12 years ago, it's changed my life. Every day I try to say, how can I live this day to the fullest because of her impact on my life?
Scott Ross is a frequent storyteller at our ArcLight events, and in his day job, he is a B2B specialist for Verizon Cellular Sales. You can find him on Twitter at Scott J. Ross.
Oh, mama, like the roses, but most of all, she cares.
You know, for any of us who've had a parent or a loved one dealing with cancer, we can really relate to Scott's story. My own mother is going through chemo right now, and I know exactly how Scott felt when people kept coming up to him and telling him that she was going to get better. But what I really take away from his story is just the hope that my mom will one day have a breakthrough just like his did.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to have that breakthrough every day. I want to live my life to its fullest, but selfishly, like everybody else, I don't want to have to get sick to have that breakthrough. It's the right philosophy to live life by.
Yeah, it's how I want to live my life too. I mean, to make the most of every opportunity. And actually, this next story is a little bit about that. We have this guy who, he and his wife go to dinner with a former girlfriend so he can kind of show her how well he's done since she's been gone. But we'll find out how that dinner goes here in just a moment. This is ArcLight Stories, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ArcLight Stories. We're bringing you true, personal stories recorded live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I am Taylor Robinson, the director of ArcLight.
Here's a question for you, Taylor. Have you ever been to one of your high school reunions?
No, not a chance.
Really? Well, why not?
I don't know. I mean, the people that I want to keep up with, I keep up with. And I
I don't know. I guess I've never felt successful enough to go back and gloat in everyone's face.
Yeah. I mean, those are the main reasons that people go to those things, right? To either see someone that you haven't seen in a while or to make sure everyone knows just how awesome you're doing.
Right.
Well, this next story is kind of about that. This guy doesn't go to his reunion, but he gets a chance to show someone from his past just how great things are going. This was recorded at an event we hosted at the Avon Theater, and the theme for the night was Out with the Old, Stories About Change. Here is storyteller Reed Lockamy.
When you are married, as I have been so many times, one of the questions that comes up and that you contemplate is who would you rather have die first? That's a legitimate would you rather sort of. You think about that because unless there's a plane crash or something, it's probably going to be not at the same time. And sometimes that's a very easy it's her. And here's how I know. Here's how I know why right now. But for me, in general, that's always been a very easy question to answer, and it's her because on the one hand, I don't want to die. I'm pretty serious about that, and also if I love my wife very much, and if I were to die, think of how devastated she would be. That would be terrible, and because I'm not too shabby and possibly immortal. I'm working on that. So there's that. When Facebook became the not MySpace thing, the new thing, the great thing about Facebook, of course, is that you would hear from people that you went to elementary school with. The bad thing was about is that now you are invited by those people to play Candy Crush every week, and that's why it won't be a thing much longer. But of course, the really terrifying and dangerous thing about Facebook was hearing from people that you dated in the past. And I don't remember, I've tried to block most of this from my memory, as you will see in the story. But several years ago, we'll say maybe, 5 or 6 years ago, I heard from someone that I had dated in high school. And I only really dated two people in high school, and they were pretty lengthy and miserable relationships on lots of levels. But so much so that, when I heard from this person, of course, my first reaction was to just really be apologetic about, so sorry about, how awful all that was. But so we, I heard from, this person I dated for 2 years, and I don't remember what the conversation was about. I guess there's a record I could go back and look. I should have done that actually before I told this story. But I felt like she contacted me, and we were talking, and somehow you came up we live in the, on the same street, so in the same neighborhood, and all this, And I don't know, this was not my idea, and I don't know how this happened, but somehow the idea was floated that my wife and I should go and have dinner with her and her husband, and that's what we did. That's even though, I knew at the time, I was like, hey, I felt like Tobias Funke, when he says, open relationships never work for anybody, but for us, maybe. And so I felt, not that, I don't want to make this sound like I was proposing an open relationship with this other fine couple. But, I thought, hey, even though this sounds like a terrible idea, maybe this will be really cool. This will be a neat sort of okay, we know each other, and now we've got four friends, and this is fantastic. We live on the same street, and it's great. So, we decided to do that. But I knew that there was going to be a lot of awkwardness in that situation because, that just sort of, you know, raises these interesting comparisons because, you know, this girl and I used to date for a long, you know, time, and now she's married to this guy. And, you know, I didn't want him to feel awkward, you know, being compared to me, you know, that was gonna be... I'm a very thoughtful person in that way, and I didn't, you know. So, but I thought, well, I'm smooth enough to be able to work that out to where, you know, he feels okay about himself. So, the night of the dinner, we drive from our house, and, you know, they live on the same street, and we're driving, and boy, it's a long street. We live in Shades Crest, and it's just a long street. So as we're watching for numbers to see, like, oh, where's her house? And we're not in the same neighborhood anymore. It's a different neighborhood. And so finally we get to the house, and it's a nice house. It's a much larger house than the house that we live in. And when we, you know, knock on the door or walk in, or the, you know, butler comes or whatever it was, the thing that I remember distinctly was there was a motorcycle, like, inside the house. And it wasn't like we're rednecks and we park our motorcycle in the house. It was like a piece of artwork, like motorcycle, inside. And so there we go in and stand around the kitchen awkwardly and, you know, have a glass of wine and, you know, try to, like, hey, I'll take another glass of wine. And this is... And so a guy that she's married to is real nice. He's like a real nice guy. And I'm thinking, okay, that's good, because this, you know, we'll all sort of be on the same, you know, level playing field. And somehow, you know, so you do the small talk thing. I didn't know this guy at all. And so, you know, questions are raised about, like, well, what do you do? And not surprisingly, he owns his own company. That's what it was, which explains, you know, like the motorcycle and the house and all this. But I was like, oh, okay. So he's probably like an accountant or something, you know, kind of, you know, boring or something. And, you know, here I was employed at a nonprofit organization in Shelby County, which was real interesting. But he wasn't an accountant. I was like, wait, so what is it you do? He's like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. And I was like, oh, all right, whatever. What is it you're doing exactly? It's like, you know, I'm designing motorcycles. We have a prototype we're working on. And it's not even like, you know, like gross crotch rockets. It's like super cool motorcycles is what this guy does. And I was like, well, that's not good. This is not shaping up the way I had envisioned this night. So there's some more small talk, and I'm, you know, I'm talking up the nonprofit stuff, and my brother and I at the time were doing a podcast. It's 10 minutes a day. So I talked about that also. And then I was like, oh wait, I was like, I gotta go in. I was like, you know, my friends and I are playing in a country western band that's called Brandon Brown and the Country Western Delight. He was like, I'm a musician too. I was like, oh, no. He was like, do you want to walk downstairs? I can show you my recording studio. And then we did. We walked downstairs, past two more motorcycles, and got downstairs. And I don't remember. I really do not. I can't even conceive of how this came up. But in all this talk of hobbies, it turned out that music and designing motorcycles and all this was not his hobby. This is totally true. He is a hot air balloon pilot. That's true. And I mean, no one is a hot air balloon pilot. No one is. That's not even a real thing. You know, I don't, And there came this point right then, I think, when I just started to feel like really bad. And it wasn't even, I didn't even feel bad about myself. I just felt like really bad for like having held her back for so long that, because we dated for 2 years. I never designed a single motorcycle. I, in truth, would probably be afraid to get in a hot air balloon. I don't understand how they work because it's just floating, but whatever, that's a... And I was just, I was stunned by not just how she had done better than me, but like how way, way, way better, way better than me she had done. This guy, so nice, motorcycle designer, hot air balloon pilot. And it made me revisit whether or not I would prefer for my wife to die first. Because as I mentioned, you know, I love my wife very much, and for all I know, there could be like a cancer-curing space traveler that she could be married to instead of like a pseudo-famous, decent storyteller. So that's my out with the old story. There you go.
Reed Lockamy is a middle school language arts teacher as well as the co-host of the Oh Brother Radio Hour. You can find him on Twitter at Reed Lockamy.
'Cause you can do better than me. But I can't do better than you.
You know, I think Reed is great. I say all the time he's my favorite storyteller in Birmingham. But I have to be honest, his ex-girlfriend's husband sounds awesome. So maybe, I don't know, his wife could have done better?
I guess it's good that most of us don't end up with our first love, huh?
I know that I'm glad that's true because our next story comes from my wife. It's about her first love, and though it may be hard for you to believe, it wasn't me. Her story comes from an event that we hosted at Urban Standard here in Birmingham, and the theme for that night was my first time, stories about new experiences. Here's storyteller Tiffany Robinson.
When I was 12, I was in a very serious relationship. It was with the dreamiest guy in school, Brody Olson. And we were very much in love. And we were the first of all of our friends in our grade to have boyfriend, girlfriend. And we were the first ones to hold hands. And we were the first ones to kiss. We kissed behind those rolls in the hallway of paper, you know, with the different color paper. Yeah, everybody knew that story in school. And so we were kind of the it couple. And when you're 12, you don't really go out. You don't go on dates. You your parents take you somewhere, and you know hang out. Our thing to do was on Fridays we lived in a small town. There's the little movie theater with one screen that my uncle owned, and our parents would drop us off there, and then we would walk down to the Pizza Hut and have dinner, and our parents would pick us up there after it was over. And this one particular Friday, we were going to go see, was it Homeward Bound? It was, yeah, a classic. And we were gonna go see that. And we had friends going with us. And one of my friends came up and said, "Hey, Brody's telling all his friends he's going to French kiss you at the movies tonight." And, oh, gosh, I started getting really nervous. And I didn't really know how French kissing exactly worked at that point. I'm 12 years old, I knew that there was tongues and spit, and it was really, kind of sounded kind of gross. I didn't really think I wanted to do it. But so I immediately start trying to think of ways to get out of it. Like I could play sick and not go, you know. But then I thought, well, everybody's going to know that I'm scared and playing sick, and so that would mean I would look like a loser, which would be worse than death to a 12-year-old. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I can just tell Brody I don't want to. And then I thought, well, he'll break up with me, and then I won't have a boyfriend anymore. And then that's worse than death to my little 12-year-old mind. So I thought, maybe I can just not make eye contact with him all night. And then he can't kiss me. If I don't look at him, he can't kiss me. So that was the plan. I was gonna go and watch Homeward Bound and never look to the side. That was the plan. So my mom drops me off in the minivan in front of the movie theater, and I realize that there is everybody that I know from school. There's 30 to 50 kids from my class alone just standing out in front of the movie theater, and they start whispering and pointing when I get out of the car, and I meet Brody, and we go sit up near the front where the cool kids sit, and we went and sat in the middle in the front, and everybody kind of started filing around us, and it seemed like they were there, I realized, to see this French kiss. Brody had told everyone in the school, not just his friends, that he was going to, because we were the first, and so I guess everybody thought that was something exciting to see, so they were all getting good seats for the show around us, and I realized I'm going to have to go through with this. I'm not going to be able to, if I don't do it, I'm going to be a big loser, so I'm going to have to kiss him. So I sit there the whole time, just not really watching the movie, holding his hand with sweat just pouring down into his hand, and all I can think about is, when is he going to do it? I don't even know how to do this. How am I going to do this? And it gets near the end of the movie, and I've been stressed this entire time. I haven't seen any of the movie. I'm just sweating and freaking out, and then he finally does this number that, puts his arm around me. I'm like, okay, this is it. So he goes in for the kill, and I don't remember any of this kiss. It's like I didn't experience it at all, and all I can remember is the crowd response to it, as they're snickering and giggling and saying, get a room and come up for air. And I was, oh gosh, I was just dying of embarrassment, and I really missed my kiss. I missed it. I didn't experience any of it, but I was so embarrassed that I decided that I couldn't handle the Pizza Hut conversation afterwards with everyone. So I went and asked my uncle if I could call my dad, and he came and got me, and I got in the car, and apparently my uncle had called my dad before I did, because Dad was saying, hey, how was the movie? Was it a good story? What happened in the movie? Tell me all about it. I thought I was going to die. And yeah, it was very embarrassing. And that was my first French kiss, as well as my first and last time to kiss for an audience.
In addition to being my wife, Tiffany Robinson is a wonderful mother and the owner and chief designer for Studio Flower. You can see her work at studioflower.com. You know, Tiffany's story is a perfect example of something that I say all the time at our events. And that is the fact that we honestly believe at ArcLight that anybody can tell a great story. And everybody's got great stories to tell. She is a very shy person, and standing up in front of a huge crowd of people who she doesn't know is not something that she would do on a regular basis. I can say that confidently because she's my wife. I know her very well. But we say all the time that anybody can do it and everybody's got great stories. And she hears me say it all the time. So that one day she just said, hey, I think I'd like to try it. And she did it. And she's told multiple stories at our events. And she's a great storyteller. That's something that's really important for us at ArcLight, is we want people to know and understand that everybody's got great stories. And if you'll just take a little bit of advice from people who know what they're doing, you can do it very well.
Listening to Tiff's story, I'm immediately transported back to middle school and remember just how brutal it could be. I mean, we didn't know anything about kissing or dating or anything like that. And the minute someone we knew was involved in that kind of thing, it not only was extremely entertaining, but it was also valuable information that we had to get for ourselves to figure out how all this stuff was supposed to work. But now when I think about it, I can't help but remember just how awkward it all was.
Yeah, but, you know, that's middle school, isn't it? Just awkward. But it's not just reserved for middle school. Awkwardness can pop up at any time, at any age. And our next storyteller discovers that when she finds herself doing something that she never imagined. Her story is just ahead. This is Arclight Stories, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for Arclight Stories. Today's show features true stories told by the people who live them, and they were recorded live in front of an audience at one of our Arclight events. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of Arclight.
And I'm story coach Chris Kinsley. I like to think of myself as someone that's open to new experiences, but when I first heard this next story, I found it almost unbelievable. It comes from an event that we hosted at Urban Standard where the theme for the night was Fish Out of Water, Stories from Outside the Comfort Zone. Here is storyteller Carrie Hill.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background before I tell you this story, just to kind of get you in this mode. I grew up as a preacher's kid, and it wasn't Southern Baptist. It was non-denominational, independent, very strict. We weren't allowed to wear pants, and we were not allowed to watch TV. We didn't have a TV until I was 15, and then my dad said, only sports. That's all we could watch. And I wasn't allowed to go to the movies. It was just really a strict upbringing. We were also very poor. It was a small church, and my dad would take my sister and brother and I downtown Birmingham, I'll never forget this, on the corners, and he would give us donuts, and we would sell donuts, and we would say it's for our church, but it was really for our family. But anyway, we were very poor. I was sent to a Christian college that was even stricter than my upbringing, and when I was 25, I was kind of, I guess you would say, a late bloomer. I had my first alcoholic drink, and I guess that was sinful, but at the time, I was like, okay. When I was 27, I worked 5 different jobs. I was a PE teacher for elementary school. I coached varsity volleyball, and I was a fitness instructor for Sports First at the time, and I taught piano lessons, and I was a waitress for Quincy's. So I worked a lot. When I was 27, my dad said, Carrie, your car has a lot of mileage on it. It only had 80,000 miles on this car, and it was my favorite car. It was a Maxima, full leather, sunroof. It was just beautiful. And my dad's like, you better get rid of it, or you're gonna have to pay a lot of money to get it fixed up. And so I took his advice and I put an ad in the paper. And this couple responded and said, yeah, we come into town, we're interested in your car. And we come into town, we're from Sylacauga, and we come into town every Wednesday, and we wonder if we could test drive your car. And I said, sure. Where do you want to meet? And then she said, well, my husband, he boxes at the circuit. And I was like, what's the circuit? And at the time, it was a dance club. And I remember my brother going to the circuit. He was the wild one in the family. So I was like, yeah, I could probably meet you there, and you can test drive my car before he boxes. And she goes, yeah, that'd be great. So we set up a time, and I was kind of nervous about going to this club because I was very sheltered, and I didn't dance a lot, but I did drink here and there, like one drink or two drinks. And, I asked my little friend. She's like not even 5 foot tall. I said, hey, Robin, do you think you can go with me to this club so that I can test drive my car, and if they buy it, then you can take me home? She said, sure, I could do that. So we got to the club that night, and it was a very nice couple, and they test drove my car, and they're like, we love your car. We want to buy it. And I was like, yay, money. And so they said, well, why don't you come into the club and watch my husband box? And I was like, yeah, that kind of sounds fun. That's something different. And it was a full-fledged boxing ring, and these guys were just duking it out for money. So we went up, and her husband was next to fight, and I was like, I'm going to get a drink. So we went and got a drink, and we were up in the balcony watching, and they said, ladies, we need some ladies down here. We need some lady boxers. And I looked at my friend. I was like, I would not do that. And another drink later, ladies, $50, win or lose. And I was like, $50? $50. And I was thinking to myself, they said, we have a girl down here, and she wants to fight. So we need another girl, $50, win or lose. And I said, I was thinking to myself, maybe I can pretend box. So I walked down to her, and she was this really buff African-American girl standing there at the table, and I tapped her on the shoulder, and I said, hey. And she looked at me. I said, is it $50 if we box? She goes, yeah. I said, you want to pretend box? And she goes, yeah. I said, well, yeah, if we pretend box, it's win or lose, right? And she goes, yeah. I said, and she's just kind of looking at me because I was in a skirt and sandals. And I was like, I wasn't really dressed appropriately, but, you know, that second drink was bad. So she goes, yeah, I'd like to box you. And I said, well, then I'll do it. If we'll pretend boxing, I'll do it. So she goes, we go to the desk, and we're like, you got two girls. We're going to do it. And they're like, really? Yeah. And so the girl that I sold the car to, she says, you're about my height and weight and everything. I think you could fit in my jeans. Why don't we go and change in the bathroom? That way you're not fighting in a skirt. I said, okay. So I go, and my friend Robin is upstairs, and she's just like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're doing this. But she stood up there. She was a good friend. She was supporting me. So I go, and I put on the jeans. They barely fit. Couldn't go out in my shoes, so we both agreed to go barefoot. So we get in the ring, and they start putting on the big old helmet on my head. They put on this big thing around my waist, which I was thinking, I need it up here. That's going to be... So they put this big thing, and they put these huge gloves, because I guess girls don't really box. And they even gave me a mouthpiece. And so, all right, Hawking, I'm in the corner, and this guy's getting me all suited up. And the girl's in the other corner, and the announcer goes, and in the right corner, we have a cheerleader. And I was like, I'm not a cheerleader. And in the left, and oh, Carrie Hill. That's what he said. Carrie Hill. And in the left corner, we have Special K. And I was like, wow, why did she get a nickname Special K? Well, anyway, I was like, okay, we're going to have fun. We're going to, woo, just pretend box. So we get up there. Oh, and the announcer says, these are the rules. You have 3 minutes. Each round. You have 3 rounds. Each round is 1 minute. You have to last each round. You cannot get knocked out or no money. And I was thinking, wait a second. I thought it was... whatever. Oh, we're not going to really fight. It's going to be pretend boxing. So there's no way I'm going to be knocked out. So they bring us together. I've got this on video, by the way. You have to see it. They bring us, and the bell rings. She comes to me, and she, bam, hits me as hard as she could in the head. And I was like, that's not pretending. And I fell back on the ropes, and she just kept hitting me in the head, and I was just like dumbfounded, like, I cannot believe she's hitting me. We're supposed to pretend here. And she would not let me hit her in the face because her hands were like this. I guess that's what you're supposed to do. And so I was just like, bam, trying to hit her from the side to get her. And then the bell rings. Well, I go sit in my corner. The water boy comes over and starts giving me water. And my hair is all in my face because she hit my head so hard. And I couldn't put it back because of my helmet. So he had to put my hair back in my helmet. And he goes, "Have you ever hit a girl before?" I said, "No." He said, "Have you ever been in a bar fight?" I said, "No." "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I said, "Is it $50? And he said, "Well, as long as you don't get knocked out." And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." So this time, I'm mad. I can't believe she hit me. So the crowd's kind of getting into this. She had her own corner of women up there, and then I had the rest of the guys and girls. So we started going, and I was doing some really amazing things. I was like doing this. I used to play volleyball, and I had a really good sidearm. And that's what I was thinking of her head, is like my volleyball. And I just kept swinging. I was swinging all over the place. Well, I got some good hits on her, and the crowd was going crazy. Well, the bell rang. This time, though, she busted my lip. And my lip was bleeding, and I was like, and I faint when I see blood, especially on myself. But I didn't. I sat down, and he's like fixing me up again and putting ice on my thing. We had like a couple seconds, I guess, in the corner to drink water and stuff. And then I had one more round. But in this round, the announcer goes, "All right, we want to see a fight. $100 to the winner." And I was like, $100? He can't change the rules in the middle of the game. I was thinking I wasn't going to get anything because she's beating me like crazy. Well, we get in there. I'm really mad. And she's like kind of hitting me every once in a while. I'm chasing her around and I'm trying to hit her as far as I can. And finally the bell rings and I'm exhausted. I don't know if you've ever boxed, but that's tiring. I was exhausted and I sit down and the owner of the club comes out and says, "We have not had a fight here with ladies in 6 months." And I bet it was Special K. That was the last person that was. "It's been 6 months, and you girls did an amazing job." And he pulled out a $100 bill, and he gave it to Special K. And then he pulled out another one, and he handed it to me. And I was like, wow, $100. That was the fastest $100 I had ever made. 3 minutes. But it was painful. It was very painful. But the girl, all of a sudden, she comes over and she grabs me and gives me a big hug. And I was like, what in the world were you thinking? And she's like, "Good job. We made $100. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. So anyway, a couple weeks later, I was walking down in Southside. And at the time, there was this place called Bell Bottoms. And they were having Jell-O wrestling. And my friends are like, "Do you want to try it?" And I was like, "No, I don't think so." That's all.
Carrie Hill is a piano and accordion teacher. You can find her on Twitter at Carrie Attune. That's C-A-R-R-I-E, Attune.
You know, Carrie has told a lot of stories at our events in the past, and she's a great storyteller. But the thing that I admire the most about her stories is it seems that anytime anything new is presented to her, she says yes, and she tries it. Like, if she doesn't think her life is in danger, she will say yes to anything once.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the things that I love most about her.
Yeah. Now, If you've enjoyed listening to these stories, we would love to invite you to come to our next live storytelling event. It's going to be May 16th at 7:30 p.m. at the Avon Theater. The theme for the night will be Wonder Woman, Stories About Moms. And we're still looking for storytellers for that event. So if you have one to tell, let us know by submitting it at our website, arclightstories.com.
Thanks for listening to Arclight Stories. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon, Brooks and Senior Etheridge, Clayton and Megan Graves, Nate Dreger, Birmingham Community Church, Red Mountain Church, the Avon Theater, Church Street Coffee, Urban Standard, and Studio Flower. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arclightstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, stay up to date on our events, and even submit your own story. After all, we're always asking, what's your story?